linoleum knife. This is linoleum knife.
It sure is.
Not Reading Rainbow or a cable access show with gently upbeat theme music.
Well, after last week's skronk that you inflicted, I thought I would take it down a little.
You took it down. You took it down to local television. I was dealing in absurdities last week. I don't know that you got my message.
No.
Yeah. Obviously.
Why don't
the noise that I helped usher in last week's program with was something that I and seven other people maybe in the world enjoy. And
bully for all of you.
That's fine.
Why don't you explain what this show is?
I want you to tell me what that music was.
That's actually the intro to a Stan Ridgway song called Newspapers.
Okay, of course. The noise, airplanes coming overhead. Linoleum Knife is a podcast about movies, and it's hosted by me. I'm the boss. My name is Dave White. I'm the film critic of Movies.com, and my sidekick, my tech guy, is Alonzo Duralde, film critic of TheWrap.com. Also on What the Flick, which is an internet program that he is a part of a quadrilateral configuration of film critics.
Right. Yeah, you're not the boss of anything. I hate to break it to you. I'm not just the tech guy. I produced the show.
Yeah, you do.
I created the show.
You
and I am the total god of you. So, just remember that.
You did. You did. You were the originator of the show. You bothered me. You asked and asked and asked for over a year. When are we going to do a podcast? My answer was always, we are never doing a podcast. Why don't you want to do a podcast? I'm busy. That was a conversation that we had. I'm still too busy to do this podcast. Uh-huh. I want everyone listening to understand that I'm giving myself to you.
Thanks. Thanks, Dave.
There's
Fave.
I give everything I got. I leave it here. On the floor, on the stage, or whatever the expression is.
That's how little you have. This is it.
And so, yeah, you started it. You came up with the name that I thought was so great. But we've been getting some flack about lately for the name.
I think people don't because get it.
Other people who understand how the world works. Clearly we do not.
The name of the show is supposed to explain
the name of the show is supposed to tell people what the show is.
I don't know that that's true. I mean, WTF with Marc Maron doesn't necessarily tell you, oh, he's interviewing comedians, you
right
know? And you know, I've never listened to Jordan Here's Jesse a difference. Go, but I have no Mark, idea what Jordan Mark Jesse
Maron,
is.
Marc Maron was famous first before he did the podcast.
Well, right, but our names are not in the title because we're not famous.
Well, that's what I mean. Like, because we're nobodies, perhaps it would have behooved us to have a podcast name.
Called what, The Current Cinema?
That would be called The Current Cinema.
But with an A.
Yes. So that we wouldn't have been, so we weren't, you know, stepping on the New Yorkers' feet.
We would do movies about fruit.
So, but we're a podcast about movies.
Yes.
And we're the hosts. And we're great.
We're okay.
No. We're more than that.
Okay. We're swell.
We're great. Right. So,
One bit of business I want to take care of real quick, because it's come up on several podcasts this week. There's a thing going on out there that I don't fully understand, but apparently there's...
And I understand it even less.
Yes. There's a phenomenon known as patent trolling, where... And it's funny, because it's similar to the thing that's been going on with a lot of movies that were made in the 40s that were based on literary properties that have never been released on video. It's because these unscrupulous lawyers go around to the different estates and say, hey, you know, the contracts that they originally signed to make... you know, this short story or this novel into a film doesn't include, you know, home video, and we can, you know, sue the studio and blah, blah, blah. And so this one ambulance chaser apparently has been going around and keeping a lot of films from being put out on DVD until the studio pays more money or something. Like, that's why Christmas Holiday, for instance, you know, based on the Somerset Maugham story, has not been released on DVD because this guy has been going around. Apparently, there's something similar to that in the world of patents called patent trolling, where people go around, they acquire, they buy the patent off of the original holder, and then they use that as a way to threaten litigation from people.
And extort money
from them. Basically extorting licensing fees from them to avoid very, very costly court battles. And that's been going on now with podcasting. Apparently, there is a set of patents that that covers the technology that is required to create and distribute podcasting. And these guys are going around and they're hitting up, I think, Adam Carolla and the How Things Work channel, and trying to shake them down for money, thinking that, you know, most people will agree to pay rather than, you know, spend the millions of dollars involved in getting lawyered up for this sort of court case. There is a piece of legislation that is now floating around called the SHIELD Act, and basically what it does is says that if you're going to try and take somebody to try and mount a legal challenge against somebody, if you're a patent troll trying to take this kind of thing to court, and you lose in court, not only do you not get whatever money you were trying to get in the case, you will also have to pay the legal fees for the other side. And if that law goes through, that's going to really put a damper on the whole business model that these patent trolls use. And anyway, if you go to EFF.org, that's EF as in Frank, F as in Frank, .org/shield, they have a very handy form that allows you to contact your legislator, if you live in the United States, and basically ask them to please get the SHIELD law passed.
Say the name of this thing again, the what? It's the what law?
The SHIELD.
The SHIELD law.
Yeah.
Or the SHIELD Act.
The SHIELD Act, yeah.
Or something.
Yeah. So, you know, the fate and future of podcasting is, you know, at stake here, basically.
If you love us.
or anybody else that you listen
to. Both of you.
You know, whatever shows that you like. If you are a podcast listener, this affects you directly. So go to EFF.org/shield, put in your zip code. It'll tell you who your congressman is, and it'll have a whole handy form to send him or her an email saying, hey, please pass this thing. Because if the patent trolls know they're going to have to pay the other side's legal costs, they're going to be less likely to try and drag people into court. End of PSA.
We need to make sure that this doesn't happen to us because
we're broke.
We have no money at all for any reason that might come up, like groceries, much less a court battle. So, they cannot be putting a damper on us and our dozen listeners. We are,
That's right.
We're not even, we're tater tots. We're not even small potatoes. Like, so it's not going to happen to us.
They're not going to get to us anytime soon. But it's the larger.
I mean, they could. They could start making examples out of nobodies, you know.
It's the larger.
Scaring off all the other nobodies.
Yeah, it's the, I'm blanking on the word that I want here. Anyway, it's a bigger issue than that. So, yeah, we appreciate any support that you can show in helping keep podcasts up and running and not hampered by
especially ours.
These BS costs. Yes.
Our vibrant podcast.
All right. Anyway, that's it. That's all I got to say about that.
What movies?
Well, what do you want to start with? Jack the Giant Slayer?
Yeah. I mean, no. What's Christie's deal?
I don't know.
First of all, I'll explain who Christie is.
Christie Lemire, our dear friend, who is the film... She's been a host. She's been on this show.
But the people might not know who she is.
She might not know. She's the film critic for the Associated Press. She was one of the hosts of Ebert Presents at the Movies during that show's run.
Did you say What the Flick
And she is one of your co-hosts on What the Flick, on the Young Turks Network on YouTube.
And she's awesome.
And we love her.
But she liked this movie.
Yeah, I don't know.
She was trying to explain it to me the other night, too, and I was like, dude, I don't even know what you're talking about.
Yeah, we talked about it on the show this week. And, of course, it's one of those things where, you know, whenever she's like, it's fun, and it's this, and it's that. And I'm like, no, it's not. It's, of course, you know.
You didn't have fun.
Yeah, I come off.
You were wrong thinking about the fact that you might have possibly had fun.
I come off as the big sourpuss for going, no.
Well, you are.
I was bored. It was
you
a drag.
You are a sourpuss.
But I was bored, and it was a drag. And it's ugly to look at.
It is boring.
And I'm fed up with the whole paradigm of, okay, we're going to do the fairy tale story, but this time they're going to have swords. Like, you know, Hansel and Gretel and Snow White and Jack and the Beanstalk. Like, okay, yeah, this has been done to death at this point, and it's never been all that much fun to watch.
I saw Oz this week, which we'll talk about
next week
later. When I came home, you said, are there swords? Is there a giant battle? And what's great about Oz, and this isn't really spoiling really anything, the witches, you know, they want to take over Oz. And so there is a battle. But it's an inventive battle, which reminded me a lot of, and this is not going to be a reference that a lot of people know, but remember in Disney's live-action hit, The Swiss Family Robinson?
Yes.
When the pirates came to the island and how they fought back with monkeys wearing dresses and coconut hand grenades and things like that. That's kind of how Oz happens. And
I just don't want another movie where Alice in Wonderland gets turned into Joan of Arc.
No. It doesn't. I little preview. I kind of dug Oz,
actually. No, you've been saying. I'm seeing it tomorrow night, Monday night, so we'll see.
But this one, yes, there are swords. And my problem with this film is not that it's extremely bad. It's just sort of everything in the middle.
It lies there.
It just kind of lies there. There's not a lot distinguishing it from any other big tentpole kind of movie aimed at a family audience. It is a children's film. I mean, it is a children's film.
Yeah.
And
no one, it's one of those movies where no one felt very happy to be there. They all kind of, everybody sort of felt like they were going through their paces.
It does look like a movie. It does, the actors all are giving performances that suggest that, you know, it's a paycheck.
Yeah.
Nicholas Holt, notwithstanding, because he's up and coming, and this is his big shot.
And Stanley Tucci dials up his Stanley Tucci villain thing. But Ewan McGregor literally looks like, before every scene, you know, he was on his cell phone, somebody kind of waved at him, and he went, and gave the phone to his assistant, trudged to his mark, and was like, okay, let's do it.
I'll be Kenneth Branagh for 15 seconds. That's kind of what he was doing.
Kind of, yeah. Now that you mentioned it, he pulled his lips in.
The I'm blanking. It's a machine. It's a machine that has all the parts, you know, already assembled, and they just lock them in place.
Yeah. And soulless franchise.
There's nothing
kind of.
There's nothing distinctive about it. There's nothing.
There's nothing
in my review on movies.com, I've said, you know, you should be able to smell the blood, you know,
of an English
like the giant. Yes, like, and you can't. There's nothing.
No.
There's nothing to smell. there are no smells. It's Febrezed, and there's a distinct lack of, you know, energy and spirit and wit. And
yeah, there's no spark to this. There's no.
They try to give Jack
no magic.
They try to give Jack some Hugh Jackman sort of not Hugh Jackman Hugh Grant style sort of like rejoinders to different things like you know, and it doesn't super work. Again, it's not terrible. Little 10-year-old boys probably will have a good time.
I guess. I don't know. I just.
And it's the story that you know, in spite of the trailer telling you don't know Jack. It is a story that you know that he sells the horse instead of a cow. He sells the horse for the beans, and it grows the beanstalk, and he has to go, and then he goes up, and it's not just a giant, it's a whole
mess of them.
An entire race of
there
giants.
There are no lady giants, though. Did you notice?
Well, they asexually reproduce.
Apparently. Like, there's not one Smurfette among them.
No, and, you know, the movie really, really loves to show you how physically gross they are. You know, they're gnarly. They're repulsive creatures. Boogers and farts but and all that stuff.
But even as repulsive creatures, they're ugly. Like,
it's ugly. It's ugly character design, and yeah. It's intentionally ugly character design. And Stanley Tucci is sort of conspiring with the giants against the king and the kingdom. The king is played by Ian McShane.
His spunky daughter.
His spunky daughter is such a played by a young woman,
Eleanor
Tomlinson,
who has nothing going on.
Yeah, and you know it's the kind of performance where you wonder. Is that how she always is?
Did they try and get something else out of her?
Is that what they wanted? Yeah. You know, there's
my joke on what the flick was. She makes Claire Forlani look like Betty Davis.
You be nice to Claire Forlani. She never did anything to you.
Hey, she's got a perfectly fine life.
I assume. Yeah. And I wish I had more interesting things to say about this completely bland, not interesting film.
It just, yeah, it's,
you would think, not making any money, I hear.
Not doing so much, no. Yeah. And it's the sort of thing where you would, what happened to Bryan Singer? That is the question.
Well.
I mean, it's like, he's the guy
This
who,
is just a misstep.
He's on a roll of missteps lately, because here's a guy who, you know, they bring him in to do X-Men and X2, you know, into the studio system, and he nails it. He really, like, makes fun and exciting superhero movies, you know, bringing his whole sort of indie sensibility with him, but, you know, but meshing well with
indie sensibility?
Well, I mean...
Can you explain that?
The Usual Suspects. I mean, he's...
Okay, sure. Keep going.
He at one point, made movies that actually had interestingly etched characters.
Yes.
And he knew how to work with actors.
Yes.
And he knew how to... And with the X-Men movies, you know, he could work on this sort of big, crazy superhero plane, but also still keep the character stuff interesting.
Okay.
But then lately, Superman Returns.
Which I sort of enjoyed.
Which, you know, it's a movie that I feel...
In fact, I really enjoyed
it. I have a certain affection for it, and there are parts of it that work, but there's a lot of it that doesn't work, you have to admit.
Okay. Sure.
Then... Valkyrie.
Valkyrie. Don't do that. Don't do that. I will hit you in the face. And hey, as you are my spouse, that would be a problem.
Yes.
Domestic violence.
That's right.
Because
the Violence Against Women Act passed.
For you.
And includes protections for same-sex couples.
It doesn't include bearded ladies.
It does, actually, as it turns out.
So
no more loopholes for the likes of you.
The, what were we saying? Oh.
Valkyrie.
You know, all right, sure, Valkyrie was not great. But,
That's
all right. You're right. Yes, your point is proven.
He's on a poop roll. So get it together, Bryan Singer. Especially if you're going to do the X-Men First Class sequel now.
It felt to me like he was distracted while he was making this movie. Like there was something else occupying his attention. There's no filmmaking stamp. Like his personality is not here.
Any number of current filmmakers could have made this thing,
right?
Like this, almost anybody who's ever directed a Shia LaBeouf movie could have directed this thing, you know?
Yes.
So yeah, me.
Lars von Trier.
Well, except for Lars von Trier, I wasn't counting him.
But wouldn't it be cool to see
his Jack the Giant?
Jack and the Beanstalk, Lars von Trier's Jack and the Beanstalk.
But see, he would do it all Dogma style, and it would be, you know. Well, no, I guess he's embraced visual effects now. That's true.
That was just a moment.
You're right. That's true. Because, I mean, obviously.
You are referring, of course, to the Dogma 95
movement,
which is not really a thing anymore. No.
I'm already blanking. What was the...
Nearly 20 years
yes,
old.
Yes, okay, yeah. I'm old. What's the movie that he just did that was so awesome, Von Trier?
Melancholia.
Melancholia, yes. Yeah. That had plenty of special effects in it.
Also Antichrist.
Boo.
Antichrist is the bomb.
No.
Yeah.
It's a bomb. another cool thing that came up this week. So you know they've been threatening this Godzilla reboot, which you know, I can only hope that they've learned a lesson from the Roland Emmerich one of what not to do. But added to the cast is Juliette Binoche.
I think that's terrific
because I think every Godzilla movie needed more Juliette Binoche.
I think so too. Is she gonna be Godzilla?
I don't think so. I suspect she's going to be either a scientist or a reporter. I'm gonna just putting that out there now.
I would like it if Juliette Binoche put on the rubber Godzilla suit and was Godzilla.
Why?
So that Godzilla would speak French.
I would rather see, like, Doug Jones get into the Godzilla costume, just because he's such a great movement guy.
Okay.
But I do not want Doug Jones in a motion capture outfit becoming Godzilla.
No. Here's... if you are not in the rubber suit, it is not a Godzilla movie.
I think that's a fair comp.
No, it is. I'm 100% right about this. That 1998 Matthew Broderick Godzilla movie,
that
was just a misnamed lizard film. That was not Godzilla. It was not Godzilla. Godzilla didn't even do anything in that movie except slink around through New York. Right. All the destruction happened because of other forces.
I don't even remember what happens in the 1998 Godzilla. Was so
and
bad.
And didn't move like Godzilla, no. Didn't act like Godzilla. You know, it just is terrible. What a terrible, terrible waste of time.
Yes.
And what an insult to the legacy of...
One of the great global cinema franchises.
Yeah, and people don't take you seriously when you take Godzilla seriously, but Godzilla movies are amazing all the time, even the bad ones. They're terrific, and Japan never stopped making them. They've made them all through up until the current, you know, moment, and we just don't see them very often unless you're a hardcore Godzilla nerd, and then you seek them out. What are you doing? Can that even be heard? You need to hold it right up to the mic if you want to have it be heard. There you go. All right, you're done. Thanks, phone.
That's my ringtone.
and the Japanese versions, they still use a person in a suit.
Yes.
That has not changed. So if you're going to make an American one, fine, do it again. You better have a person in a suit, or it's not Godzilla. I decree now.
No, I think you're right. I mean, there aren't a lot.
This is not just my truth. This is a universal truth.
There aren't a lot of rules in art, but I would say yes. It's not a Godzilla movie unless it's a dude in a suit.
Yeah.
Because then it becomes something else.
Or Juliette Binoche.
Or Juliette Binoche in a suit. Yes, fine. I don't think she's going to be in the suit. Just a hunch.
Now, if they want to do a remake of Gamera in the United States, that would be fine, too, but you need a person in a turtle suit.
Well, okay, no, those new Gammers...
Possibly Marissa Tomei.
Yeah, there you go. Now, those new Gammers in the 90s, were those turtle suits, or were those...
Yeah.
Really?
Guardian of the Universe, the one that we went to see?
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Okay, because those were good. I like those 90s.
I mean, Gammers. I'm sure also partly because Gamera flies, there's modeling involved as well. But when Gamera's, you know, moving around, that's a dude in a suit.
It's funny, because we'd been talking about Juliette Binoche, I pulled up on YouTube last night the clip of where she wins the Oscar over presumed favorite Lauren Bacall.
Yes.
Just because I wanted to see the look on Lauren Bacall's face. I had forgotten that Juliette Binoche was wearing this crazy outfit with a really, this very big sort of wing collar thing coming off the top. Right. And so I thought, actually, she should play Jet Jaguar. Because she's kind of wearing the same outfit.
I would appreciate Juliette Binoche as Jet Jaguar.
Yeah.
Also, and that's from Godzilla versus Megalon.
Right.
Megado.
Look it up, kids.
Yeah.
She looked like one of the Shogun warriors, basically.
Yes. I'm good for all of this.
Yes.
As long as the aesthetic
of Godzilla is properly.
Yeah. properly executed.
Gotcha. Speaking of Asia, also opening this week is 21 and Over.
Yes.
The directorial debut of the dudes what wrote the Hangover movies. And it is clearly a close cousin to the Hangover movies. It's a story of collegiate debauchery.
They should have, as I recently said on the Twitter, they should have just called it Hangover Kids.
Jim Henson's Hangover Babies.
Nobody's going to see this movie, just like nobody's going to see Jack the Giant Killer.
Yeah.
Or Slayer.
Right. So Skylar Astin and Miles Teller play two high school friends who travel to visit their friend, played by Justin Chan, who is turning 21, and they want to take him out for a wild time, but...
To drink.
But
binge drink.
Basically, yes.
Alcohol poisoned drink.
But their friend, Jeff Chang, and he's called Jeff Chang throughout the film, that's the way we Which always I call you Dave White.
I understand now, apparently, is meant to be a running joke.
Yeah.
That they call him Jeff Chang. But I didn't think about it as a joke. Because every single person I know calls me Dave White.
Right.
They don't say, hey, Dave. You know, my old friends from way, way back in the day, high school, occasionally will refer to me as David, which is weird, as my family used to do that.
Right.
They
still do.
My family still does occasionally call me David. Certain old high school friends will as well, although... In high school is where I made that transition. A group of my friends in high school started calling me Dave, just without my asking them to.
Huh.
And it stuck, and it just became the way I refer to myself.
And now in the adult world, everybody knows about 10 Davids, so you know,
right. You're Dave White. Right, so I'm Dave White, and everyone calls me Dave White. Like there's not even a space between the E and the W, and that's what they do in this movie. I get the joke now, but all through the movie, because I do the same thing to Gary Cotty.
Exactly. Gary Cotty.
You know. Anyway.
Whereas
I realize I'm telling you fascinating things. Keep talking.
Back to 21 and Over. Yeah. But Jeff Chang has a med school interview appointment in the morning, and, you know, tries to beg off, but they're like, oh, no, one beer. And, of course, it becomes a whole wild, crazy night, and then they have to figure out how to get him home. And, you know, hijinks ensue. And the hijinks are funny.
Yeah.
You know, for this kind of movie.
They're empty, but yeah, they're funny.
For that, this kind of silliness, they're plenty entertaining. However, 21 and Over has more on its mind and wants to be about... You know, like, what happened to our friendship, and what's going to happen to us after college, and is Jeff Chang okay, and, you know, and it just, it tries to get all deep. In my review on the rap, I said, like, if you're going to be Animal House, be Animal House, and if you're going to be the Breakfast Club, be the Breakfast Club, but it takes a real skill to try and be both in one movie, and these guys do not pull it off.
The minute they decide they're going to get all real talk,
yeah,
that's when it all, it's like this... It's like a chill over the entire thing. Like the entire audience just sort of stops laughing.
Yeah, like, oh, you're not going to be cartoon characters anymore?
Yeah, and you've already done outlandish things and defied the laws of human, you know, ability to withstand physical, you know, abuse.
Right.
You know, you've done things that make it, you've done things in this film already that would actually kill all of you.
Yeah.
Or at least hospitalize you for weeks. And everyone just bounces up right back from it, like Melissa McCarthy in Identity Thief.
Right.
But in Identity Thief, and I'll give Identity Thief a little credit here, she's consistent through the entire film. She is like, you know, one of the Three Stooges where you just bonk them on the head and you hear the birds tweeting, and then she just sort of goes, whoop, 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 and keeps running.
Although this movie kind of shares a thing with Identity Thief in that it starts out, it gives you the slapstick, but then also expects you to care about the pre-wings and the problems, you know, and that's, you know, it just, and not that you can't do that in a movie, but these guys, whoever's making these movies,
don't set up an outlandish, absurd situation and then pull the rug out from under me and tell me, oh, but really this movie's about friendship.
Yeah, exactly.
No, it's not. It's about boobs and puke.
One credit that I will give 21 and Over is that for whatever they do that sort of reeks of white male privilege, and I'm not including Jeff Chang in this since he spends most of the movie as basically a prop because he's passed
out. He's kind of like the Weekend at Bernie's.
Pretty much, yeah. But everything.
But he's really funny as that.
Yeah.
But before he passes out, he's really funny, yeah. Especially the sequence where they're going from bar to bar.
Mm-hmm.
And they tell him before they go out, they're like, "We got your ID because you still look like a 12-year-old Chinese girl." And he goes up to every one of the bouncers and is like, "Ha ha!" You know, like, that's funny.
Yeah, no, he's lucid, he's funny.
And but as a physical prop, he still gets to do some funny.
Yeah,
like
he gets crammed onto the dashboard things. Of a smart car.
Yeah, he's good.
But what I was going to say was that everything that the Teller and Aston characters do that sort of reeks of like dudeness, right. they get a really effective comeuppance for,
and sort of
more effective than in most of these movies, where it's just considered that you get to glide through and do whatever you want. Like these guys actually have to pay some consequences,
the most minor of consequences. Honestly, it's not. No, only if you're the most tightly wound straight dude would you think that comeuppance was serious. Seriously, it's not. That comeuppance is minimal. It's not even a comeuppance, really.
They get branded.
So what?
Which I only mention because you see it in the first few seconds of the film. So it's
you
not
do,
a spoiler.
Yeah, you do see it. But it's on their butts. It doesn't matter.
Still.
So, the... yeah. Anyway, the movie is predicated on a certain cocoon of dude privilege.
It's more class privilege.
Again, both. Okay. Both of those things. And it's not it detours down this road of we're gonna get serious here, but no one's really gonna have to get, you know, no one's gonna have to do anything really to change or earn anything, because we're letting everybody off the hook. Because
that's true.
Yeah, and so that was extremely annoying to me, and now an even weirder development.
Yes,
and I'm going to read you a thing.
This is kind of a two-parter because first we had heard that. For the Chinese market, which is a giant film market now, and so I think more and more we're going to be seeing Hollywood studios, you know, keeping them in mind for things and amending things on their behalf. So in the Chinese version of this movie, it's this cautionary tale wherein Chinese student Jeff Chang comes to America, falls in with some debaucherous, you know, Westerners, and learns his lesson and comes back to China to get an education.
A real education.
So there's that. And then it turns out this gets weirder. Somebody alerted me to this on Twitter. And
here is an excerpt from the AP story. Rights activists have criticized a Hollywood studio for filming a buddy comedy in an Eastern Chinese city where a blind, self-taught activist lawyer is being held under house arrest and regularly beaten. Relativity Media is shooting part of the comedy 21 and Over in Linyi, a city in Shandong province, where the activist Chen Guangsheng's village is located. Authorities have turned Chen's village of Dongshigu into a hostile no-go zone, and activists, foreign diplomats, and reporters have been turned back, threatened, and had stones thrown at them by men patrolling the village. Relativity declined comment, but said in a press release that filming in Linyi began last Wednesday. Now, this is from October 2011, this story. In the release, Linyi's top Communist Party official, Zhang Xiajun, is quoted as calling Relativity's chief executive, Ryan Kavanaugh, a good friend, while Relativity's co-president, Tucker Tooley, describes Linyi as an amazing place. Chen Guangsheng is the blind Chinese civil rights and anti-poverty activist who gained international fame for his work documenting the Chinese government's policy of forced late-term abortions and sterilization. He was arbitrarily detained in August 2005 and escaped house arrest in April 2012. Relativity Media caught the ire of a lot of Chinese human rights campaigners and passed off their allies. Oh, caught the ire of a lot of Chinese human rights campaigners and pissed off their allies in the West. Picking Linyi as a film location is probably not a good idea, but signing a deal with Zhang Xiajun, a person who is directly responsible for one of the most egregious and cruel abuses of a human rights defender in China, is really beyond the pale. Nicholas Begelin, senior researcher in the Asia Division of Human Rights Watch, told The Wrap, your employer.
Yeah. We'll post a link to this on our Facebook page.
So that's really weird.
Yeah,
and
here's tone deaf.
Here's the weirdest, I think, thing about it. The Hangover movies are all set. You know, are they all? Wait a second.
How many? No, the first one was in Vegas. The second one was in Thailand.
The second one. I'm sorry. Let me get my facts right here. The second one set in Thailand. And turns this Asian country into sort of, you know, this non-entity sort of place where we can go and do what we want. And I think that's a really funny sort of, not haha, but funny, weird parallel to this situation where we're going to go to this country where, you know, people do terrible, the government does terrible things to people. And
ignore all that.
We're going to ignore all that. We're going to do whatever we want. We're going to make a party comedy, you know, and change the film, change the film's entire premise with the stuff we're going to shoot there.
Just so we can make all this much more
turn money. It into a cautionary tale.
Yeah.
Instead of a you know, a rock'em sock'em, let's puke kind of movie. By the way, the greatest vomit scene.
Yes.
That has...
In some time,
yeah. Little aside there. I just think it's bizarre that they're doing this.
It seems, I don't know. It's sort of like Google. Everybody thinks is, oh, it's the hip company and they're so good to their employees and da 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 da. But then they were completely willing to sign on to like censoring themselves in China so that they could get to the Chinese market.
Yeah,
I feel like like no one's established the rules yet of like, if you wouldn't do it here and it would get you bad press here, then don't do it in China either.
Because there's the internet.
Yeah, like we all know now. Everything is global.
The internet knows everything about what you're doing. So it's, I don't know how that, they'll get away with this.
It's because like if you're Brad Pitt,
people don't care.
If you're Brad Pitt and you go to Japan to make a beer commercial, now we all see it.
Right.
It's on YouTube.
Right.
You know, and if you go and shake hands with human rights violators, we all hear about it. You right. Know? So, yeah, I don't know.
It's like Dennis Rodman going to North Korea.
Perfect example.
saying that the
Kim Jong-un.
Yeah, he's a great guy.
Well, you know, George Hamilton used to go shoe shopping with Imelda Marcos and take her to Studio 54.
Yes, so. He did. I'm sure she was a wonderful dinner companion.
I'm sure she's a great hostess, no doubt. Everyone's an idiot.
They'll totally get away with this, too.
No, of course.
It'll cause this momentary sort of, hey,
yeah.
And then no one will... Because they are that invested in getting the movies released over there.
Right.
And they're learning the rules. Like, it was happening for a while that they were cooperating and still the movies were still not getting released.
Right.
Because, you know, after the 11th hour, some Chinese official would be like, wait, no, not this. You're dead. You're dead in the water. I think with stuff like this where they're like, okay, we're willing now to go to you,
right.
Shoot stuff there that changes everything about the movie.
Yeah, because the only way we're making any money now is if our movie opens in China and does really well. So sure, we'll totally kowtow to whatever ridiculous strictures you've got, and we will get in bed with, like...
Anybody.
People. Yeah.
Yeah.
Ugh.
Essentially making an entirely different movie. Like a different cut entirely. Yeah. So... Very weird.
Very.
I can't wait to see that footage because it'll get out.
Oh, that's true. Yeah.
Thank you, internet.
Hopefully,
it will get out
with subtitles.
Well, yeah, yeah.
What else this week? Phantom.
Yeah. Yeah. So there's a submarine, Soviet 1968 submarine. There's a bunch of Americans on the submarine.
Pretending to be Russians.
But they're Russians.
No, what he means is the cast
is American. Why don't you explain this extremely boring movie to everybody?
The cast is American, but nobody does a Russian accent, so they're all just sort of being...
Which I'm fine with,
which honestly. Which is a cool idea.
Actually, I'm okay with
it, that. That actually gives it a certain consistency. Although I didn't notice until you pointed out that nobody has 1968 haircuts.
No, they don't.
Or certainly not 1968 Soviet Navy haircuts.
The puffiest hair in this film. Like there's Jose Hebert is off to the side.
Fluffing them up.
In this Russian sub. Giving them all little fluff outs.
Just shake your head, darling.
Yeah.
You can see you're going to pay me what? Well, it's okay because you don't have to do a Russian accent and you don't have to cut your hair. Oh, all right, fine. Anyway, it's supposed to be based on a true incident, although you find out from the closing titles that nobody really knows what happened exactly.
Yeah, yeah.
This one sub went missing and then they found it later and here's what we think could
and it's
have
all
happened.
Classified, so
yeah.
So it's all speculation totally, what actually goes
yeah.
down.
So this has all the validity of one of those alien autopsies. You know, some say they built the pyramids. Did the Loch Ness Monster build Stonehenge?
Ed Harris is the captain of the sub. The sub's going to be sent off to China, actually.
Yeah, but both Ed Harris and the sub are like, you know, have seen better days,
right.
And he's about to retire, but they give him one last assignment, which is to captain his old submarine, which they're about to fob off on the Chinese.
You're back in the game.
Exactly.
Bigger than ever.
And so, you know, he's on there with his usual crew, which includes William Fichtner and Jonathan Scheck and Jason Begg, and... But then suddenly we get these two new guys on the boat, David Duchovny
and his... some other guy.
His sidekick.
Yeah.
With this thing that's under a tarp and no one's supposed to look at it.
Right.
And they get out to sea.
Their motives are questionable.
Yeah.
Like, one knows. What? Why are they here? Well, we don't know. Okay, we'll let them come on the sun.
Yeah, they're KGB. That much they know. So, turns out that the thing...
Here comes the spoiler. Are you going to spoil it? By telling
people, I'm not going
to
tell them everything.
What David Duchovny and the guy are up to?
Well, I will tell them this much.
All right.
The thing that they brought aboard the sub is a device.
It's not a good device.
Well, it's a cloaking device for submarines.
That's right.
It's
not a good device.
It throws off sonar so that you can basically travel invisibly to other ships and not be detected.
Yes.
That is the phantom of the title.
Yeah.
And they plan to use that in a rather nefarious scheme, which we won't give away on the off chance that anybody sees this
and
movie.
And we assume it's true.
Yes.
It really happened, just as they say it happened. The problem with this film that should have been very exciting and tense,
yes,
is that it is not exciting or tense. There is
not much. No, there were a few times.
There's
but not
some conversation, like it's nonstop conversations. It reminded me of a much more grown-up, stone-faced, but completely not entertaining 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea. And
without the octopus. With,
and there's no giant octopus fighting Kirk Douglas.
Well,
that's a bummer.
It's basically kind of a mutiny movie.
You're going to have a submarine movie. Stuff needs to happen. And there should be a giant octopus.
Well, also, if you're going to have a submarine movie where you've got like two opposing groups of people and they're trying to like sneak around each other and do their thing and subvert what the other one is trying to do, you need to have a stronger idea of the layout of the sub and where everything is, because it's not that big. You could easily sort of imply,
right,
you know, map it out for us where everybody is in relation to everybody else, because that's essential.
It all seems to take place in the same control
room. Yeah, like there's one hallway.
And it's like 3 feet wide, so it's a very sort of like...
claustrophobic. As most sub movies are.
Closed off. Sort of, well, not 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea.
That's true. That's a pretty big sub.
That's a big submarine. That's expansive.
That's like the Life Aquatic submarine. Under the big, you know.
There's a conservatory in the, in the 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea. The big organ.
So what we're really saying is go see 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea instead of
You know what? I would just T-Bone Voyage to the Bottom of the Sea as well. I love submarine movies. And I don't love this one.
It's no Das Boot.
There are a bunch of other submarine movies out there. U-571 also.
Didn't see it.
Totally entertaining.
William Fichtner is really good in this. I always like William Fichtner. And I think he and Ed Harris have an interesting sort of, you know,
kinda
history going on there. I mean, and it's a strong cast, but it's not very compelling. It's
inert.
Yeah. Yeah. Also opening this weekend in limited release was Stoker, which I saw, but Dave didn't see it. So we're going to save it and talk about it next week because I have a hunch we're going to argue about it.
But what I saw and you didn't see and that we're going to talk about right now because you're not going to go see it.
What's that?
The Last Exorcism Part 2.
Oh, correct. I am not going to see it. So go ahead.
Everything was great before the movie started. I went to see Oz on the Disney lot. That was at 7. Over in Burbank. And then they trapped us in the lot and I couldn't get out.
And you almost ran over Manola.
And I almost ran over Manola. She has no idea that it was me. That was the best part. Mm-hmm. Is that she came out of nowhere and I was trying to find my way out of the studio because they closed off the gates. Mm-hmm. Why do you do that? You've got a whole theater full of people in your main movie theater in the middle of the lot, and you close the gates so no one knows where they're going. People who don't work on the lot, who don't know their way around, you're driving around like, is there a gate around here that's not completely locked down?
So you were trying to follow Harriet Tubman. There was like one golf cart that was leading people out to the...
Yes. And Manola popped out from behind a building and was like yelling at me. It's like, people are walking. I was like, I'm sorry, Manola. So, yeah, that happened. But she still doesn't know that it was me because it was dark.
And I'm sure she's not listening to this
and
thing.
She's not. Exactly. And so, it will be a funny story when I see her sure next time. I get out. I finally find my way out, and I drive over to the AMC Burbank 16 for the 10 o'clock first screening.
Now, of the movie. You know what I like about the AMC Burbank 16?
What do you like about that?
Place? They have an IMAX theater that is a real IMAX theater.
Okay,
it's not LIMAX.
And what I like about the AMC Burbank 16 is that, compared to the other people who go to the 10 o'clock movies on Thursday night, I'm 1,000 years old. I don't understand who's letting these children go to movies on a school night at 10 o'clock. That's my first thing.
I blame the parents.
That I don't understand. It's a PG-13 film, so anyone of any age was allowed in, and they were all there. It was a packed house.
It was a hootenanny.
Furthermore, yes, it was a hootenanny because it was a radio promotional screening. I love a good radio promotional screening.
Especially when you've paid to get in.
Yeah, I know. That was the weird part. Well, a lot of the people had free passes.
Well, clearly, if it was a radio screening.
Yeah. And which confused me because I was like, well, how were they? Were they going to like not let in the paying people? Like, I don't understand.
I'm sure they blocked off a chunk of seats for freebies and then sold the rest to suckers like you.
The radio, I can't remember now what radio station it was, but the DJ from the radio station was really funny. Yeah, actually genuinely funny and just sort of cracking on people like in the audience. Like he walked past me and he was like texting, not paying attention to what's going on because I was texting you about how ridiculous everything was around me. But he commented to me. He was like, look at this guy texting. I was like, yeah, look at me texting. I'm young.
But I'm going to pay attention to your business?
Yeah. Oh, you're so fascinating to me, on-air radio personality. He had a con. It was a giveaway T-shirts.
Yeah, of course. Always.
Contest. I miss the T-shirt cannon. I have been to many radio screenings. Radio-sponsored screenings, and back about 5-6 years ago, the T-shirt cannon was ubiquitous.
Oh, yeah.
It would just shoot the T-shirts out of the people. Somebody must have gotten hit in the eye with a T-shirt.
And ruined it for everybody.
I don't see the T-shirt cannons happening anymore, and that makes me upset.
Somebody went crying to his mother, and so now none of us get to have T-shirt cannon anymore.
So, but they had a T-shirt giveaway, and it was... What girl has the weirdest thing in her purse contest? And the DJ was the one, the on-air personality guy was the one judging this contest. But the one, the woman who won was the clear winner because she had a purse full of fried chicken.
I hope at least it was a lined bag.
I don't know.
Maybe she was a member of the Hollywood Foreign Press Association. Possibly. And she had just come from the junket of something.
Maybe, yeah. I mean, it was a brilliant move on this woman's part to bring an entire like bag full of fried chicken to the theater. I wish I had been sitting near her. Maybe she would share and give me a wing or something. A wing or other dark meat. My favorite.
A wing is white, actually. Maybe that's the new KFC thing instead of the bucket.
The wing's white meat? I thought it was
thigh and leg is dark
breast. I like thigh and leg. Yeah.
You know, maybe the new KFC promotion, instead of a bucket, they give it to you like, you know, in a Birkin bag. Yeah. Yeah. $10,000.
$10,000 purse full of fried chicken.
Yeah. So. I smell art installation. Get Damien Hirst on the line.
So this woman had a bag full of chicken, and the DJ's like, "You snuck all that chicken into this movie theater." She's like, "Uh-huh." So then the movie starts.
Eli Roth
was there. So was Ashley...
Bell?
Bell, I think that's her name. The woman in the movie who actually gives a really good performance. She's very... you know, shell-shocked from having lived through the first film.
The first Last Exorcism.
Where she was exorcised. And also...
the previous Last Exorcism.
Also, the penultimate exorcism.
Previously on the Last Exorcism.
Where she was raised in a religious, fundamentalist sort of backwoods homeschooling cult-like atmosphere.
Ashley Bell, yeah.
But also had a demon in her. So she had the double whammy. She had the horrible, crazy, lunatic Christianity... and then the horrible Satan entering into her. Well, actually, one of Satan's minions, right. Abalam, who's a demon in Christian theology. A real fake demon in Christian theology. And so,
who put the Abalama baby into Ashley Bell? Ding dong. Who put the ooh, mow, mow, into my smile, child? That is why. You're supposed to do the deep part. That is why. That is why.
That is why.
You are my sugar diddy. Yeah.
Are you going to leave that in the episode? You're going to just...
that's going in.
That little interlude, spontaneity moment from you of singing?
That's why people tune into this.
America's thing. Film critics got singing now.
Go on.
She's really good in the first movie and this one. She has that great sort of like timid, fearful quality. But also in this film, she's taken out into the real world again and is enjoying that discovery. You know, there's a boy that I like and I'm learning things about my body.
Daddy, there's a boy at the door.
Ghost hands in the night are helping me learn about my body.
Oh boy.
Yeah. And so... naturally, the devil wants back in. And so what you have here is a film that really wishes it could be sort of like a Repulsion-style movie where there's a sustained dread and long, long takes and, you know, tension. And then because it's PG-13 and the audience for a PG-13 movie needs...
as a cat jumping out of the closet.
Yeah, cat jumping out of the closet. There's a lot of that, and it just disrupts everything constantly. Mm. So it's like this movie that is at odds with itself. Hmm. It's not great.
Did you like the first one? The first last?
Oh, the first one's cool. Huh. Yeah. The first one is cool, and it keeps you guessing, and then gives you this twist ending. Mm. And this one is just sort of...
was it R there. Or PG-13, the first one?
I don't remember. Mm. I think it might have been PG-13.
Oh, okay.
But the first one was cool. And this one's just sort of not... yeah. Hmm. If I'd had a purse full of fried chicken...
it would have been a whole other story.
It would have been a whole other story. My favorite thing that happens in the movie, though, is that this sort of... it's in New Orleans... So there's this whole, like...
jazz funeral?
There is, yes. There is one of those. But there's also... it's Mardi Gras, you know. There's also this sort of spiritualist cult that wants to get the demon out of Ashley Bell. Mm-hmm. So they're the ones that are going to perform their own sort of, you know, pagan exorcism. And
which brings us back to chicken.
The main lady in the cult, she's got this, you know, turban on and everything. What do you know? She brings in a chicken, a live chicken.
Maybe the lady with the chicken in her purse was sort of like Rocky Horror. She's going to throw it at the screen or something. It's an interactive.
This is a chicken that they want to use as a sacrifice. Right, like the demon's going to go into the chicken. You know, like in the Bible, apparently Jesus drove some demons out of a guy and into some pigs or some sheep, and they threw themselves off a cliff or something like that. That's a story in the New Testament.
That rings a bell. Yeah. You're more Bible-y than I am.
And, ring a bell. And so they want to put the demon in the chicken. They're not going to fry it up into a delicious treat.
And the lime into coconut.
Yeah, it's not... When the chicken comes on screen, I was like, hey, she's got a chicken just like you.
Where's Lisa Bonet?
Right. Exactly. So, that's not a good movie. Mm. I wish it had been a good movie. There will be a third Last Exorcism, I'm sure.
God.
Last Exorcism.
No, really, for sure.
It'll go right to DVD. It'll go right to DVD, probably. If we're lucky, then I won't have to watch it.
They still haven't subjected us a second... what was that really terrible movie that opened in January of last year?
You're going to have to narrow that down.
The one where they go to the Vatican.
The Devil Inside.
The Devil Inside, yes, okay.
Yeah.
I thought for sure we'd have had Devil back inside by now. Yeah. Okay.
Got a DVD.
I do. My DVD this week is Criterion Collection just put out Jean Rouch's Chronicle of a Summer. Now, this is...
I have never seen that.
This is, I think, the first documentary I ever saw.
Where did you see it?
The summer of after my junior year in high school, I did I got to take a college level film class, and it was sort of a survey course that started with
silent. Wait, where did this take place?
It was at Harvard.
Okay, I remember now, because that was, you went there.
It was a summer program.
How did you wind up at a summer program in Harvard in high school? That's the part I've never... I know this story now.
I was
confused for a second. I wasn't trying to dig that out of you.
Okay. There was a catalog that popped up in my high school, and somebody said, hey, you should apply for this. And I was like, okay.
Wait, Javier?
Javier and Fernando.
Javier and Fernando, your two older brothers, had already...
They're already gone.
They'd already graduated from Harvard.
Yes.
Okay.
They graduated in the 70s, and this was like 1987.
Okay, so it wasn't like a thing where my older brothers went here and you have to take me for the summer course.
No, I just filled out the thing. I don't think they asked me about if I was a legacy for the stupid summer high school program. So no, it was great. So I took a journalism class, and I took a Classics of World Cinema, and the first half of it was all silent. And it ended with...
Where did you stay when you did this?
In a dorm. I had two roommates.
So you were completely stoked to be out on your own.
Yeah, it was great.
At Harvard, in a film class, all summer.
Yeah.
You were in teen nerd heaven. All right.
Also, because the Harvard Square Cinema was still open, and it was like across the street from our dorm, and they did rotating Woody Allen double features all summer long. So that was a
formative
experience.
So all you needed really to make this the best thing of your entire life was a purse full of chicken.
Pretty much.
Every day.
Yeah, that's all I needed. anyway, so then in the second half of the class, which was taught by Bill Rothman, who wrote a book called Hitchcock, The Murderous Gaze, G-A-Z-E,
yes.
we did a documentary, and we did Jean Rouch's Chronicle of a Summer, and it's this very kind of landmark early 60s French film. It's almost an ethnographic film where they would basically ask people on the street, are you happy?
Right.
And then it would kind of go from there into other discussions, and they talk about, you know, the war in Algeria and other stuff that was going on.
Yes.
And it's where I learned that most people misuse the term cinema verite.
Yes.
Because people think that anything that's a documentary, anything that's just, you know, like straightforward, you know, yes. Cinema verite. Cinema verite means you can see the boom mic. It means like you, like crew members appear on screen. It right. is completely like there is no illusion of anything going on. Like you are in the middle of a set, basically. Correct. That is what cinema verite is. And,
yes.
And Chronicle of the Summer is that. So yeah, so it is now out on Blu-ray, and because it is... because it's Criterion, they have a whole bunch of cool extra stuff on it, and I recommend picking it up. It's a cool movie.
Mine is also a Criterion film.
Mm-hmm.
We saw it because for your birthday a few years ago, everybody right. chipped in and got you the Janus box set.
Yes. Which
50 classics yeah. of world cinema. 50 DVDs
when
huge box.
When Criterion had their 50% off sale earlier this week, that was one of the things you could get wow. for half off.
Is the sale over?
Yeah, it was a 24-hour sale.
Golly. Well, you had the chip. You had folks all chip in yeah, to buy it for
I
you
got
for
this
your
for retail.
Yeah. And so we watched Fists in the Pocket
mm-hmm.
one night. It's in the box set. But it's also, you can just get the DVD from separately, Criterion. Yeah. It's Italian. 1965,
Marco Bellocchio.
Marco Bellocchio, and it was his debut film, his first film, and it is mind-blowing. I can't explain it better than this little Criterion blurb. I'm just going to read it.
Okay.
Tormented by twisted desires, a young man takes drastic measures to rid his grotesquely dysfunctional family of its various afflictions in this astonishing 1965 debut from Marco Bellocchio. Charged by a coolly assured style, shocking perversity, and savage gallows humor, that's for sure.
Yeah.
Fists in the Pocket was a gleaming ice pick in the eye of bourgeois family values and Catholic morality. A truly unique work that continues to rank as one of the great achievements of Italian cinema.
Yeah. It's a movie that's almost 50 years old, and it's still like, what?
This is the most blasé, unhappy, disturbed family.
Mm.
And yet, all through the movie... it's pretty funny.
Yes.
Just how awful they are. And I had not heard a single thing about this movie. I didn't know it existed, okay, until we watched it.
Mm.
And the minute we stopped, the minute it was over, I knew, like, this is one of my favorite movies of all time. Someone recently sent us a letter, and I'm going to read it here in a minute. But
About your DVD pick?
A little of my DVD picks, a part two to this thing. But, yeah. if you ever watch the DVDs that I recommend, this is like them.
It kind of reminds me of Godard's Weekend.
Yes.
In just as being sort of just blistering and
yeah.
savage and ruthless and dealing with family stuff, you know.
Right. Okay, letters.
Letters. We got some. Thank you. After I complained last week, we got some letters.
After we begged for mail.
We got some tweets this week and everything. It was great. Listener Wendy said that she got the Rex Reed joke on the Academy Awards because of us.
Okay, I clicked on it.
Oh, what have you done?
Hang on, just relax. I'm clicking on the email.
Okay, I had to stop taping because Dave can't make his email work, but I found it in my...
It's not my fault. The computer is wrong.
Mm-hmm. Okay, this is an email from Colin. Recently discovered your show and have been working my way through about the last 6 months of episodes. Two of the types of podcasts I most commonly subscribe to involve old married couples bickering and people reviewing films. So, Linoleum Knife is a perfect combination of two of my favorite types of show.
Do you think we bicker? I don't know that we... Do we bicker?
Well, I mean...
We engage in spirited dialogue. I would...
We disagree fervently at times.
Well, yeah.
That would count as bickering.
All right.
I just wanted to say that Alonso is dead wrong about Les Mis, Dave is dead wrong about the Touring Horse,
no.
and you're both dead wrong about Holy Motors.
No. Who's this from?
Says his name is Colin.
Mm.
The touring horse made an otherwise happy person insanely angry. Oh, sorry. Les Mis made me, a straight guy, cry. The touring horse made an otherwise happy person insanely angry with how dull and repetitive the whole thing was.
Now, now, now.
And Holy Motors drowned me in so much pretension I couldn't care in the least about it. Now I've made you suitably angry, knife away at my... Now I've made you suitably angry, knife away at my top 10 list. I know for sure I'm not going to be 100%.
I'm not angry about the touring horse not like, because... It's a tough movie, and Bela Tarr, you know, I would say that one of the themes of this film is the sort of drudgery and repetition that is involved in the lives of these people.
Right.
And so, yes, it is repetitive.
Well, and I get that I'm in the minority on Les Mis. I'm right, but I'm in the minority, so, you know, whatever.
And Holy Motors is beautiful.
Holy Motors is awesome. And
yeah.
Okay. So here's this guy's top 10 list. Rashomon.
Yep.
12 Angry Men. Groundhog Day. The Shawshank Redemption, to which he writes, I'm sorry, Lonzo. This is the best portrayal of the triumph of the human spirit ever committed to film. To which I say, you need to see more movies, Colin. 7.
Now, you don't know Colin. You don't know how many movies he's seen or if he needs to see more. Maybe he's seen a lot of them.
If
maybe
he's super smart. If he thinks Shawshank is the best portrayal of the triumph of the human spirit.
Oh, all right.
He's not seen enough movies.
Okay.
Gross Point
Blank. I just don't want to alienate new listeners.
You know, look, he threw down first. This is what he wanted. I'm giving it to him. Gross Point Blank. Kiss Kiss Bang Bang, yes. Control.
Control is really great.
Yeah. Amour and The Avengers. Because, yes, Holy Motors was no The Avengers.
Well, it wasn't. No,
I like both.
You love both of those.
Both of those movies were on my top 10 list. Since I did it for my own podcast, I may as well share my top 10 of 2012 as well, even if it is a bit late in the year. A couple of caveats. This is a list of films that were released in the UK in 2012, so fantastic films like Zero Dark Thirty are not included, because that was released in January over here, and I have different criteria for films that I enjoyed most in a specific year compared to those I think will stand the test of time, which is my Amour is only number 4.
I see.
Number 1, The Avengers. Number 2, Seeking a Friend for the End of the World.
I did not like that film.
Number 3,
I did not find that film successful.
Sightseers, not out in the U.S. yet, but appeared at Sundance, so fingers crossed. Is that the movie from the guy that did...
I don't know. What is that movie, Sightseers?
It's from that Ben What's-His-Face, the guy who made that movie about the cult with the twist ending that people thought was so awesome, even though you could see the twist ending coming from a mile away. I'm blanking.
I don't know.
Amour, Cabin in the Woods, The Artist... technically a 2011 film, but released after Christmas, so by my rules, eligible for my 2012 list. Mm-hmm. Looper, Paranorman, Your Sister's Sister, The Hunger Games. I know I'm going to get a serious linoleuming for that one, but sue me, I really enjoyed it.
Do your thing. Do your thing.
Boom! Hunger Games! That was
Saturday Night Live.
Saturday Night Live, Sofia Vergara was on.
I just like it when you... I like it when you impersonate Sofia Vergara.
Well, Gary Cotty actually does it better than I do. But I got no beef with Hunger Games. It was fine for a while. It wasn't my top 10 list.
I had a great time with Hunger Games, yeah.
Out of curiosity, have either of you seen the low-budget British gay film Weekend, written and directed by Andrew Haig?
Yes, we have.
Yes, we have. It was my number one film of 2011, actually.
It's terrific.
One of my top 5 films of 2011, and possibly one of the sweetest and most realistically complicated romances in film, gay or straight. Really enjoying the show, and keep on knifing Colin in Bath.
Oh, Bath.
Yes.
So what are we knifing his lists as?
Well, I am not giving him Shawshank or Gross Point Blank.
Oh, Gross Point Blank is nice.
It's no High Fidelity. That movie's got back up. So I'm gonna say 80.
I'll give you 90 because I like Shawshank and I like Gross Point. I don't think they're top 10 of all time material, but I enjoy them. So I give you 90.
Okay.
Yeah.
So you get an aggregate 85% knife.
90 with prejudice because you didn't like Touring Horse. And that movie is perfect.
So there, Colin. Thank you for writing. We also heard this week from Chris. I have such a hard time choosing my favorite movies, but here's my list of movies that I love and have watched many, many times. Brazil, Raiders of the Lost Ark, Videodrome, yep. or almost anything by Cronenberg except A Dangerous Method, which was boring, and Keira Knightley's monkey shrieking was the worst performance ever. I'm with you on that one. The Shining, Silkwood, The Meaning of Life, Annie Hall, The Empire Strikes Back, another vote for Groundhog Day, and Working Girl. Your podcast is one of my favorites, and listening to your bickering, this is the theme again, today too,
yeah.
usually takes my mind off whatever strenuous exercise I'm doing, Chris. I'm going to go 95% knife. I'm going to go half off on Working Girl. Not a that movie.
I like Working Girl.
Do you want to give him 100?
Yeah.
All right.
I'm pro Working Girl.
Okay, fine. I don't hate Working Girl enough to make an issue of it. So you are 100% knife, Chris. Now do more of those leg something. I don't even know the exercise terminology. Keep climbing that Stairmaster, whatever you're. Regan writes, "Hey guys, I claim to be a huge fan of your work, but for whatever reason, just discovered this podcast earlier in the week."
So that's fine.
You're a poser, but you're fixing it. So that's a good thing.
Now he's a huge fan.
I'm going by what he said. He claims, but no, he's fixing it. That's what matters. Needless to say,
I like our listeners more than you do.
I am grateful to all of them. Needless to say, I've gone back a few months and into the archive and have enjoyed every bit of it so far. Anyways, I have more of a comment suggestion, not a question. Since Dave's DVD recommendation is usually something beautifully disturbing, why not set aside a moment towards
the end? This is the email I was talking about earlier.
Why not set aside a moment towards the end of the podcast dedicated to said suggestion? That way, even if the DVD suggestion in any given week isn't a film that involves a man forced to sacrifice his wife in order to allow his children, who will still somehow die the following year, to live happy lives... I don't think that's actually a film. It just sounds like something Dave would suggest. There would still be a part of the pod that allows him to reference something of that nature. Or not. Either way, let's keep Dave's disturbing DVD of the week coming. Keep up the great work, John Daigle. We have a DVD section every week, and you get your half of it. So that's Dave's DVD of the week, disturbing or otherwise.
I was going to say that next week I'm going to choose the Three Lives of Thomasina, but that is actually also
disturbing.
That is a disturbing film. That movie, when I was a child, made me cry and cry and cry. Mm. It's one of my earliest memories of having a movie like wrench me. And I was five, but it just ripped me in half because that cat just kept dying
over and over again. One more.
Influence on me.
Katie writes in with title is Best of 2012 so far. Hey guys, I know you've been facing a dearth of emails lately, and I've been waiting to send you my Best of 2012 list until we've actually watched all the 2012 heavy hitters, still missing things like Lincoln, Skyfall, Holy Motors, etc. But given your email shortage, I figured I'd go ahead and send you my list of greats from last year in no particular order so far. The Master. The Kid with a...
Thank you.
The Kid with a Bike.
Also great.
Magic Mike.
Yep.
Moonrise Kingdom.
Yep.
The Deep Blue Sea.
Yes.
This Is Not a Film.
Yes.
Following that up, here are some movies that delighted me but didn't quite make the capital G great list. Bernie.
Yes.
The Raid Redemption.
Yes.
Sound of Noise.
Yes.
I Wish.
I don't know what that is.
Is that like a Korean film, maybe?
Maybe.
I'm not sure what that is either. Killer Joe. Goon. Yes. And 21 Jump Street. Knife me. I'll send you an addendum when we see the rest of the movies from last year in the next month or so. You are great. Keep up the good work, Katie.
That's 100%. You have great taste.
Yeah. I'm less into Magic Mike than you are, but for bringing up The Deep Blue Sea and This Is Not a Film and Bernie, and we're going to give you the benefit of the doubt on I Wish because we don't know what it is. We're going to look it up as soon as this is over. Yes, you are 100% knife, Katie, and you are cognizant of our email problems and filling in the gap, and we appreciate that.
So, is that it? That's all
that the emails? All right. As always, we thank you for joining us, and we suggest you check out our friends in the podcast universe, The Comedy Couch with Dennis Hensley and Tony Tripoli, Cooking with Malcolm Ingram, Fat Guys of the Movies, The Criterion Cast, Throwing Shade, Team Jack, The Schmoes Know, The B-Movies Podcast, Film Spotting, SVU, Pod Crash, Game Night Guys, and Secretly Timid. You can subscribe to this program for free at iTunes and leave us a review there, which would be awesome. We've been getting some lately, which we really appreciate. The more positive reviews we get, the more people are able to find the show. You can stream the show at Stitcher Radio or thelounge.com. Now we ask you to follow our Facebook page. Sorry, like our Facebook page. Linoleum Knife Podcast. You can follow us on Twitter at LinoleumCast. You can also follow us separately. I'm at Aduraldi, A-D-U-R-A-L-D-E, and Dave is at D. Leland White. You can check into the show at getglue.com and drop us an email at linoleumpodcast@gmail.com with your top 10 lists, questions, comments, thoughts about chicken or China or Godzilla or anything else. We really appreciate hearing from you. And we will be back next week to talk about Oz the Great and Powerful and Stoker and, yep, and plenty of other stuff. So we hope you'll join us then.
And Dead Man Down, which is being slinked into theaters, skulking its way into theaters on Friday, produced by the WWE,
but directed by the guy that did the original Dragon Tattoo trilogy, right?
I don't know.
I think
it's got Colin Farrell
and
it's got
Noomi Rapace.
Noomi Rapace, and they're pretending it doesn't exist.
So yes, we'll be covering lots of cool stuff next week. We hope you're here for it. Bye.
Goodbye.